plan forever, but at some point you have to execute. It was time for Reese to do what he did best. It was time to start killing. He had only 4 targets on his list at this point, but as he started taking them down, he would generate further actionable intelligence and more names would emerge. It reminded him of the hot and heavy days at the height of Iraq's insurgency. They would hit a house, roll up some bad guys, and exploit the intel gained from the site. Within the hour, they'd be hitting another house down the road based on the information they'd gleaned. It would go on and on like that, house after house, night after night, as they dismantled the enemy's network. Based on the intel from Holder's hard drive, he had developed a basic sequence of how he'd implement the plan. This group had the resources to scatter if they knew he was onto them, so timing was crucial, as was the importance of making each hit look as little as possible like the targeted assassination it actually was. It was also time to move. The LA shooting had cemented beyond a shadow of a doubt that someone or something had targeted him, just as they had his family and his SEAL troop. Reese used Spider Oak to leave Ben a message asking for access to a safe house. Ben responded immediately, saying he would be right over. But against his better judgment, Reese wanted to spend one more night in his home, with the memories of his wife and daughter. Ben sent the address and urged Reese to get over there as soon as he could. Reese spent the rest of the night looking over emails, maps, and images on Google Earth, cross-referencing dates, times, and places. By 3 o'clock a.m., he had built target packages on his 4 targets. High-value individuals, Reese would have called them at work. He checked the news sites again for any updates on the Chinatown shooting and, satisfied that they knew very little, rigged explosive charges to the front and back doors before passing out on his couch for some much-needed sleep in his body armor, his M4 close at hand. Chapter 36. San Diego, California. The place was called The Landing Strip, a classic trashy double entendre related to its location near the airport. This was no gentleman's club with dress codes and top-shelf liquor. This was a down-and-dirty strip club straight out of the 1980s, and Reese was fairly confident that he'd hear Motley Crue playing when he opened the door. He had been in his share of adult establishments as a Navy man, especially in his enlisted days, but he never really got the point of throwing money at women who were among the least likely on earth to go home with you. He always thought it much like a restaurant where you paid to look at the menu and smell the food but couldn't actually eat dinner. He paid the $5 cover charge to a heavily tattooed bouncer with a shaved head, the kind of guy who likely relied on size and intimidating looks rather than actual fighting skill to keep the clientele in line. It was just after 5 o'clock p.m., and the place was almost empty. A few sad sack middle-aged or older men feeding dollar bills to the dancers in exchange for conversation with women who wouldn't otherwise give them the time of day. The place was exceedingly dark. Reese doubted anyone would sit down if the lights were on. What little illumination there was came from a few neon and black lights placed in several spots on the ceiling. The black lights were flattering to the blemished skin of the dancers, but gave the whites of their eyes and teeth an odd, almost alien green glow. A DJ in an elevated booth looked over the scene like a prison guard surveying a cell block from behind bulletproof glass, pumping out music that was far too new and loud for any of the patrons to appreciate. Reese took a seat at a small round table in the corner, as far away from the stage as possible. He smiled to himself, recalling how he and his teammates used to describe the front row of seats as Pervert's Row. There was always one guy who insisted on posting himself there as if he'd never seen a naked woman before. A cocktail waitress, who appeared to be more attractive than any of the girls on stage, approached Reese's table to take his drink order. He ordered a beer, which was delivered swiftly. He paid for it in cash, leaving a nice tip, but not enough to be remembered. Each girl would mount the long stage and do a 2-song routine as they disrobed and performed acrobatic feats on the rotating brass pole while wearing obscenely high heels. After their dance, each stripper would make her way around the room, asking the men to tip her dance while sizing each customer up for a private show in the secluded section of the club where the real money was made. The girl who was on stage when Reese sat down was way too attractive to be working in a place like this. Who knew what motivated her to work in such a shithole? You wouldn't get the real story if you asked anyway, and he had enough problems of his own without trying to save every 22-year-old stripper in San Diego. More than one young SEAL had been led astray by the legendary stripper with a heart of gold. He nodded politely and tucked a dollar bill into her garter when she came by his table asking for a tip. The next girl up to the stage was overweight, possibly even pregnant, and stomped awkwardly across the stage in heels that made her look that much more ridiculous. It would have been amusing had it not been so sad. A hand on his shoulder pulled his attention from the stage. Reese looked up at a tall, gaunt figure standing over him. She asked in his ear if she could sit. He motioned to the seat next to him, but instead she sat side saddle across his lap. She was wearing a black nighty and G-string bottoms with the stripper standard clear high-heeled shoes. She had a gold hoop in her nose, and the majority of her body was covered in tattoos. Her hair was dyed jet black, which contrasted with her pale skin, like the keys of a piano. She was exactly what Reese was looking for.
"I'm Raven,"
she announced, her hands on his shoulders. "Your parents must have predicted your career path at a young age," was Reese's pithy response over the blare of the music. She either ignored the joke or was too much on autopilot to notice.
"You're too cute to be in here. What's your story?"
"Just looking to have a good time."
"Isn't everybody? Care to buy me a drink?"
Reese knew the scam. You buy the dancer a drink and she splits the cost of the overpriced champagne, or worse, fruit juice, with the house. "Sure," he answered. Raven waved to the cocktail waitress, who brought over some sparkling liquid in a champagne glass, and Reese threw a 20 down on the table. "Keep the change if there is any." He earned a knowing grin from the cocktail waitress.
"You're pretty fit,"
Raven opined as she patted him on the chest.
"You don't look military and you're too old to be a baseball player. Construction?"
"Something like that."
"You want to go for a private dance? I'll take real good care of you."
"How about we sit here and talk for a minute? I'll make it worth your time."
"I love to talk, baby. Not like there's anyone else in here for me to talk to anyway."
"I'm guessing you like to party?" Her eyes lit up at the dog whistle term for drug use.
"Oh yeah, I love to party. You don't look like a party guy."
"You never know, do you? You holding?"
"I can be. What are you looking for?"
Her playful demeanor turned all business as she ditched her dancer hat for that of an opportunistic drug dealer. "Something for my back. Loratab, Roxy's, Perks, whatever you got."
"I think the DJ has some Doan, big wafers. You're not a cop, are you?"
"I am most definitely not a cop. How much?"
"Let me ask him."
She strode quickly toward the elevated DJ booth and disappeared up the steps. She came back 2 minutes later, her eyes narrowed as she grinned mischievously. She sat back down on Reese's lap, this time straddling him.
"He's got four. He'll sell them for $100 each. I'm not making anything, I'm just hooking you up."
"Sure you are," Reese thought, but didn't say aloud. Based on his research, he knew the price was highway robbery, but he didn't really care. He reached into his pocket and handed over four $100 bills. Raven tucked them into the front of her panties and retrieved a packet of foil from the same, tucking it in Reese's shirt pocket. He was somewhat relieved that he didn't have to touch it with his hands.
"Thanks, baby,"
Raven said as she leaned in and kissed him on the cheek. She climbed off his lap and he headed for the door. Back at home, Reese put on a pair of nitrile gloves and retrieved the foil-wrapped package of pills that he'd bought from Raven. Despite the perception of methadone as the therapy used to treat heroin addicts, the compound's primary use was as a pain reliever. Reese had learned that methadone is very tricky to prescribe since its therapeutic dose overlaps with a potentially lethal dose, and as a long-acting opioid, its half-life is also very long. Nonetheless, many providers use methadone for the treatment of chronic pain due to its low cost. He'd read a series of news articles about Medicaid patients accidentally overdosing on their methadone prescriptions and studied a slide deck from a conference of medical examiners on the prevalence of adult males in the U.S. dying of prescription drug overdoses, mostly by what they referred to as polypharmacy. Reese placed two large methadone tablets in a small plastic baggie, along with two tablets each of the alprazolam that he was given at Balboa, and some carisoprodol that he found in his own medicine cabinet, left over from a neck injury he'd sustained a couple of years earlier, playing rugby with some British counterparts during an exchange program. He dropped the baggie inside a larger Ziploc bag and laid it on the kitchen counter. Using a small hammer, he pounded the tablets until they were reduced to a fine powder. He put the baggie into one of the pockets of his small nylon pack and dumped all of the remaining pills down the toilet. He then collected the prescription bottles and gloves into a brown paper grocery bag to burn. All of his gear was laid out on the floor of his home's one-car garage. Weapons and the assorted kit that one accumulated over the years in the profession of special operations. He cleaned and lubricated weapons, loaded magazines, and prepared demolition charges. He did it the same way that he had for countless training and real-world missions over the past 18 years. Only this time he wasn't doing it alongside his teammates, though he hoped that they were watching from above. Each item was checked off a list as it went into the various kit bags and equipment cases that lined the closed garage door. Despite his desire to stay at home surrounded by what was left of his previous life, he was clearly too exposed. Reese would take along everything that he needed to complete his mission and set up his base of operations in Ben's employer's condo. At 6 o'clock a.m., the next day, after another night sleeping in body armor, Reese's white Land Cruiser was loaded down and heading east on Interstate 8. Reese sipped coffee from a Yeti Rambler travel mug and felt a slight relief from the tension that had wrenched his body for weeks. His mind was clear and there were no signs of a headache. He reached over and turned on the stereo, heard a familiar guitar riff from one of his favorite bands, and managed a confident smile as he pulled out of the driveway to AC/DC's Highway to Hell. Chapter 37. Capstone Capital Corporate Offices, Los Angeles, California. This thing was starting to turn to shit. James Reese had a decidedly bad habit of not getting killed, and it was beginning to cause serious problems among the interested parties. J.D. Hartley had demanded an in-person meeting, and his assistant called Mike Tedesco to let it be known that he was on his way to L.A. His jet would be landing at Santa Monica in an hour, and he'd be at the Capstone offices shortly thereafter. Saul Agnon scrambled to arrange the impromptu meeting between J.D., Horn, Howard, and Tedesco. The latter three were waiting impatiently in Horn's conference room when they received word that the congressman was in the building. The entire success of RD 4895 was contingent upon the Hartleys' continued support. The consummate politician, no one could recall ever seeing J.D. Hartley with so much as a hair out of place. With a commanding height of 6'3", a thick head of salt-and-pepper hair, and a 365-day-per-year suntan, you knew Hartley was somebody, even if you didn't know who. He walked into the frosted glass conference room and sat at the massive black marble table without greeting anyone or shaking hands.
"Tell me you have a plan, gentlemen."
Horn spoke first.
"Congressman Hartley, it's great to see you as usual, though we all wish it were under better circumstances. As you know, efforts to remove Commander Reese from the situation have been problematic.
Problematic? Is that what you call it when my wife gives you the keys to the intelligence kingdom and you fuck it up? First you send a bunch of wetbacks in to do the job when the bastard isn't even home, and then you blow it when we put a damn jihadi ready to martyr himself right into your lap?
Sir, Agent Holder was handling the sleeper asset, Captain Howard interjected.
Don't you fucking blame this mess on Holder. He's more competent than all of you in this room put together. What are you going to do now? Do you even have a plan to take this guy out?
Sir, if I may.
Horn spoke up, attempting to regain control of the meeting.
As you know, Capstone has a security element of very experienced individuals. Our men have all been working overseas thanks to the DOD contract that you and the Secretary have so generously allowed us. But I've called a team back to the States. These men will hunt down James Reese and finish the job at all costs.
No, they won't. I'm not going to have a bunch of private military contractors with ties to my wife getting in goddamn gun battles in the suburbs. You keep those men on a leash until I tell you otherwise.
Yes, sir. I understand. Horn replied.
I don't know that you do understand, Mr. Horn. If the damn media gets a hold of this, they will turn it into a tabloid show full of every bullshit conspiracy theory that floats down the creek. I cannot afford to have my wife exposed to any bad press on this. We have worked for a decade to rebrand the Hartley family name, and we are not going to have it thrown in the garbage over a favor that we've offered you people.
Sir, we are preparing charges against Commander Reese. I could have him arrested on my order at any moment. You just say the word, an eager Leonard Howard offered.
Great idea, Counselor. Put him in custody where he's impossible to kill, and some Navy doctor who we can't control can diagnose his tumor. Thanks, but no thanks. Gentlemen, you get this shit handled, or you won't be able to count on the support of the Secretary whether this pipe dream comes to fruition or not. Keep Agent Holder in the loop, if you please. Now I have other business to attend to while I'm in town.
Everyone in the room knew that the congressman's other business meant something young, blonde, and silicone-enhanced. J.D. Hartley rose from the table, buttoned his coat, and turned his back before anyone could so much as offer a handshake. Chapter 38 Arizona Desert. East of Yuma, Arizona, Reese found a road on the map that looked like it headed south into relatively empty desert. A trail cut east that showed no signs of recent traffic. He took it for several miles until he found its terminus, then made a U-turn and returned to a spot he'd seen roughly halfway down. He drove off-road slowly, being careful to avoid the largest of the rocks that were strewn on the ground to the horizon. He put the cruiser in park and cut the engine, taking an empty cardboard box from the passenger seat before he walked around to the rear to open the hatch. He moved a suitcase and two smaller duffels, pulling away a blanket to uncover the large plastic case underneath. Unclasping the latches, he reached into the foam interior and pulled out a laser rangefinder, which went into his jacket pocket. Using a staple gun from one of the duffel bags, he attached a large piece of paper printed with a grid pattern to the side of the cardboard box. The blanket that had been covering his cargo was spread on the ground with the leading edge in line with the rear bumper. Reese carried the box out into the desert a distance before removing the rangefinder from his pocket and aiming it back toward his truck. He picked up the box and took several large steps backward before taking another reading with the rangefinder. Satisfied, he placed the box on the ground with the paper side oriented toward the truck. He then put a rock the size of a soccer ball into the box and closed the lid. Reese returned to the cruiser and opened the back passenger door, taking a soft rifle case from the floorboard and placing it on the blanket. He moved to the back of the truck and retrieved two sand-filled shooting rests, positioning them at the front and middle of the blanket before removing a set of electronic earmuffs and a plastic ammunition box from one of the bags. Pulling the earmuffs over his hat, he knelt on the blanket and unzipped the padded canvas rifle case to reveal a hand-built hunting rifle. The man who built these only made 10 or so per year because he spent so many hours getting them as close to perfect as his abundant skill and patience allowed. Reese would be traveling very near the spot where this rifle was created. Too bad he wouldn't be able to pay its maker a visit. Reese opened the bolt and arranged the rifle so that it was balanced on the two shooting rests, one on the fore end, one at the butt. He moved himself into a prone position behind the rifle and opened the translucent blue plastic ammo box. 50 copper projectiles gleamed in the morning sun, each looking as if it could rocket to the moon. He smiled as he thought of his father carefully loading each of them by hand at his bench. He took a cartridge from the box and inspected his